From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Opioids, including prescription drugs and heroin, killed more than 33,000 people in 2015. Those numbers are on the rise, creating an epidemic.
We'll discuss the opioid crisis with a Mayo Clinic expert.
Literally millions of people have died from accidental prescription overdoses. Understanding how these medications can be used safely and in some instances not used at all is very important to daily clinical practice.
Also on the program, we'll learn about Mayo Clinic's billion-dollar electronic health record upgrade, the enterprise-wide switch to Epic.
And we'll preview the Transform Conference put on each year by the Mayo Clinic Center for Innovation.
All that along with this week's health and medical news right after this. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Tracy, according to the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in the last 15 years, the number of people who have been given an opioid prescription and the number of deaths from an opioid overdose have nearly quadrupled.
Wow.
I mean, it's like we're handing this stuff out like candy.
Hmm.
Big problem. The alarming statistics don't really stop there. It's estimated that more than 12 million Americans misused prescription opioids last year.
There's no doubt that we have an opioid epidemic in America. So what's at the root of the problem and how can we find solutions? Here to discuss the opioid epidemic is Mayo Clinic anesthesiologist and pain medicine expert, Dr. Michael Hooten. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Hooten. It's good to see you again.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What is it that makes you interested in studying opioid abuse?
The interest stems primarily from the fact that literally millions of people have died from accidental prescription overdoses. And understanding how these medications can be used safely and in some instances not used at all is very important to daily clinical practice.
We have a problem. How did this problem get so big so fast?
Well, I think we have to look back in history just a little bit. So if we look at what happened in the 1990s, early to mid-1990s, there was a big push to focus and treat pain, both acute and chronic. And as a result, opioids were presented as the safe approach to treat both of these problems.
How much history do you know there? Why did physicians before that not care about pain? Is it because we didn't have a drug that could address it?
I think physicians have always cared about pain, but thinking about treating chronic pain with high-dose opioids, that was the change in overall clinical practice. Prior to that time period, opioids were significantly only limited to individuals with acute pain or cancer-related end-stage hospice.
So it started getting prescribed more to more patients.
The medical profession took a lot of grief back in the 1990s for not controlling people's pain, right?
Correct.
And that was the impetus for handing out more pain medications, but then that created a separate problem.
Correct. And then throughout the first decade of the 2000s and then extending on today, we've seen the number of prescriptions rise, the overall dose rise. There seems to have been a plateau in 2010, and there's been a slight reduction in both the quantity prescribed and the number of prescriptions since 2012 through approximately 2015.
Would it be fair to say that we overdid it in the opposite direction?
I think that is very accurate. Definitely the drugs, looking back, were clearly overprescribed for individuals who had chronic pain.
Was it because no one gave enough attention or didn't give enough respect to the how addictive these drugs can be?
Correct. And I think that in the mid to late 90s, the focus was not on the potential long-term effects of these drugs when used in a population of people.
Do we know how these drugs work?
Yes, yeah. So opioids work in the dorsal horn of the spinal cord, and it alters the
dorsal
way.
Horn?
Yeah, what does
you
that mean?
You got horns in your spinal cord?
No, you have to help me out here. I'm the layperson. What does that mean?
Yeah, so opioids primarily work in the spinal cord itself, and they help modulate and change the way that pain signals are processed through the spinal cord and how those signals eventually reach our brains.
And if you take opioids, And give us some brand names so people really know better what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. So probably two of the most widely prescribed drugs, oxycodone and hydrocodone. Vicodin, Lortab is a trade name there. Those are the two that are most widely prescribed. There's also a long-acting formulation of oxycodone called OxyContin. Other drugs that people may have heard of are Dilaudid, otherwise known as hydromorphone. Fentanyl can be a widely prescribed drug, and the abuse of fentanyl is actually on the rise.
And how long does it take a person to become addicted?
It's very interesting, and it is very individual. You can talk to some people that have opioid use disorder, and they will tell you, I was, quote, hooked on the very first dose, and they knew because of the euphoria that they felt that this was going to be a problem. More typically, people will require longer dosages for a longer period of time, and that can be the nidus for ongoing problems with the drug.
Is it true that most of the people who get started on these drugs find them in the medicine chest, in the medicine cabinet?
That is a way that typically, for example, younger people, children, who may find these medications in their parents' medicine cabinet. The drug may have been there for 3 or 4 years. It was prescribed after an operation. And so that supply of the drug could be the source of initial use for certain people.
So the efficacy of these drugs doesn't run out? I mean, isn't there a period of time when they should be thrown away?
Yes, and many people would suggest that when the prescription is done, or for example, when the medication is completed and you no longer need it, any residual drug should be immediately removed from the house and disposed of.
Can you flush it?
Probably not the best idea.
Why?
However,
because the water quality people in every city where that's happening don't like it, because then it's in the water.
Because you can detect very, very low levels of various medications, including opioids. However, if we have to weigh the risks and the benefits, we would definitely like to prevent the horrific problems associated with a opioid use disorder.
You mentioned just a moment ago about people knowing that they're hooked the first time that they take it because of that euphoria that they feel. Mm-hmm. How come, of course, it's easy to just look in hindsight, but how come there wasn't a way to keep track of those patients as they were going through? For me, when I've had to take it, I get sick right away. Right. So there was no inclination for me to want to take even one more dose if I could avoid it. Why wasn't there more effort made to follow those patients if you did have this, all of a sudden you get this wild euphoria from it?
Mm-hmm. I think in the past it was not fully recognized. However, in the current environment, I think clinicians are much more vigilant about asking patients if the drug is being used longer than anticipated. Why is it being used? Are they experiencing any effects that could be deleterious long term?
And what happens when you do overdose? Do people die of respiratory failure? They quit breathing, or why do they die?
That is the primary reason for death is respiratory depression. And at that time, when the respirations are depressed, let's say to 2 or 3 breaths per minute or no breaths per minute, obviously the person is unconscious and they can't even be woke up, even with physical stimulation.
So how do you figure out that it is an opioid overdose so that you can give the antidote? And what is the antidote?
Oftentimes, the clinical picture may strongly suggest that it is an opioid overdose, especially if it's a younger person who is not breathing or breathing at a very slow rate and they're obtunded. And there may be collateral information or historians around them that could tell them that, yes, opioids have been used.
Obtunded?
Just completely unconscious, almost as if the patient is anesthetized.
Okay. Yeah. All right, so they're sort of out of it, and you kind of suspect that it's an opioid overdose, particularly if a younger person, and then what do you do?
And then the treatment of choice is Narcan. So it's a medication that reverses the effects of the opioid, so it actually displaces the drug from those receptors that are causing the respiratory depression.
Mm-hmm. And it works?
It works very effectively.
Oh, amazing. Our guest is an anesthesiologist and also a pain medicine specialist, Dr. Michael Hooton. We're talking about the opioid epidemic in America. Time for a short break.
When we come back, myth or matter of fact, 91 Americans die each day from an opioid overdose. We'll find out.
I hope it's not true.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
We are talking about the Opioid Epidemic in America with anesthesiologist and pain medicine specialist, Dr. Michael Hooten. We'll talk about potential solutions in just a second, but first, myth or matter of fact.
91 Americans die each day from opioid overdose. Is that a myth or a fact?
That is a fact. And I remember the time when it was 37 a day.
Wow.
So we've almost tripled that.
Yes.
Incredible. You know, one of the concerns for someone who becomes addicted to an opioid is that it serves as a gateway drug to something even worse, like heroin, right?
Yes. And oftentimes, many people that are addicted to heroin, if you talk to them carefully, they will say that possibly their initial exposure to opioids as a drug class occurred in the medical setting. Maybe they were prescribed the drug after an operation or for trauma, and when they're no longer able to get consistent access to the drug, then they will turn to heroin.
Heroin's a little easier to get than the opioid, or it's just whatever's available?
It's whatever is available. And if you go online on the internet, you can find pricing for these various substances on the street for different counties and states. And
really?
Oftentimes you will find that heroin is priced lower than some of the prescription medications on the street.
And you can find that information on the internet?
Unfortunately. But what physicians can do is that we can reduce the number of people that otherwise don't have an addictive disorder, but yet if they're exposed to the drug, they may develop that. Mm-hmm. So at least we can reduce harm in that way. Individuals that already have an addiction, yes, they're going to go out and find the drug regardless.
We mentioned briefly in the first segment fentanyl. What is that and how is that becoming part of this issue as well?
Well, fentanyl is an old drug. It's been around for decades. It's a synthetic opioid, highly potent, primarily used in the operating room. But more recently, because of its potency, people in the community have actually started manufacturing it illicitly.
No.
And given the high potency of the drug and concerns about is the concentration accurate or not even really knowing the concentration of what you're producing, people will use the drug and, again, because of the potency, will have an unanticipated accidental overdose. Because most accidental overdoses are associated with another drug, particularly benzodiazepines, Valium, Ativan, Xanax, those types of drugs.
So we said 91 people are dying every day, and you remember that when it was back to 37. Do you think that we're going to stop at 91, or do you think it's going to get worse before it gets better?
Well, if we look at what was published from the CDC, in the July 6th issue of JAMA, they reported 2015 data. That's the latest data that's available. And it clearly showed that parameters of prescribing opioids, including number of prescriptions and total dose, has actually declined since 2010, 2012. But paradoxically, the number of deaths attributed to opioids has actually increased during that time period. So there's been some improvement in the clinical use or provision of these drugs, but yet the horrible adverse effects are still on the rise.
Is that because those people that are moving from an opioid over to heroin and fentanyl?
That's a possible explanation, but more than likely it is a multifaceted problem, and there's probably multiple reasons attributing to that issue.
All right, we got to talk about solutions, because I'm sure you've got some ideas on that front. And obviously, physicians are part of the problem. In fact, a recent Mayo Clinic study showed that 4 out of 5 surgical patients get too many pills. So you have your wisdom teeth out, you get 30 pills, you probably need 6, right?
Correct.
Or you need it for a day or two or three. But for some reason, and part of it was the fact that we were criticized for not controlling pain, you get 30 pills and 25 of them end up in the medicine cabinet. So physicians are part of the problem, but there's got to be some other things that could be. We're not the entire problem, right? We're not the whole problem.
No, we're not the entire problem, but we can definitely, as you suggest, alter the way that we practice, because it's very clear that in the acute postoperative period, a greater exposure to the drugs for a longer period of time, in other words, greater dosages for a longer period of time, is associated with unanticipated longer-term use. So simply reducing the number of pills and the dose to the bare basics, it could be a very life-saving intervention for some individuals.
So what else can we do?
I think other approaches would be focusing on other non-opioid medications that may be helpful and help with postoperative pain. In the chronic pain arena, looking at behavioral approaches, procedural interventions that may be helpful as well. Again, back to the acute postoperative period, some of the regional anesthesia procedures, nerve blocks, putting various long-acting local anesthetics in different joints after an operation can be very helpful as well and can reduce the use of opioids afterwards.
Dr. Shives mentioned that the prescription would be 30 pills. Is that because prescription guidelines just said we do 30 pills when we hand out a prescription? And are those changing?
There was no guidelines per se that suggested we need to use 30 or 60. I think it was just a routine clinical practice that just emerged out of practice patterns. But publication of the CDC guidelines in 2016, you know, suggested that the number of postoperative pills prescribed should be reduced and the duration of exposure should be, you know, 3 to 5 days in that arena.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of reasons for it. Number one, the pills are cheap. Number two, you don't have to worry about the patient calling you back for more pain medication because you've given them more than enough.
Right.
So in a way, it was selfish, I would say. So if someone is addicted to opioids, how tough is it to get them off? If I say to you, you know, I'm addicted, I want you to help me, how do you do it?
It's a very, very tough addiction to treat. Number one, if you're receiving or using long-term opioids, the physician should be able to help taper those medications. Sometimes that taper can be slow. Sometimes it needs to be very rapid. Once you're off the medication, then need to be referred to an addictionologist that has experience treating opioid use disorder. And that is the term used today for this problem.
Well, isn't that interesting? Have you ever heard that word before, an addictionologist?
Right. What is medication-assisted therapy, MAT?
So MAT refers to the use of two opioids to help reduce craving for the drug to allow the person to kind of develop other coping strategies and approaches to managing their addiction long-term. Those two drugs, number one is methadone, that's been used for decades for heroin addiction, and the other one is buprenorphine, which is an opioid agonist-antagonist. So it kind of stimulates at the same time it blocks the opioid receptor.
So who's the setup to have this problem? You mentioned young people, and why is it that young people seemed more prone to become addicted than older individuals?
There are some very well validated, if you will, risk factors for opioid use disorder. Number one is young age. Younger people seem to be more vulnerable to addiction. Could it be the circumstance or context within which the drug is being used? Possible. Another is male sex. Previously, men were at increased risk for compared to women, but now that gap is closing. So women may be at equal risk, young women at equal risk to developing the problem. Also, a history of psychiatric illness, specifically depression. Also, smoking is a risk factor as well. And a previous history of substance use, including a family history of substance use. And again, that suggests that there's a genetic vulnerability to this problem.
So we all need to check our medicine cabinets and make sure we don't have any old opioid in there. Oxycodone, OxyContin, what'd you say, Dilaudid?
Vicodin.
Yeah. Yeah, you better check yours when you get home because you got some youngsters around.
Don't worry, I've already done it.
All right, we've been talking about the opioid epidemic. It's a problem that we all need to be concerned about, and hopefully we as physicians can help solve it in the future. Anesthesiologist, pain medicine specialist, Dr. Michael Hooton, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll hear about Mayo Clinic's large change management undertaking, the Plumber Project.
And later on in the program, we'll preview the upcoming Transform Conference hosted by Mayo Clinic's Center for Innovation.
Do you have a health-related question you'd like us to answer or a topic you'd like us to cover? You can tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio or send us an email at mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu.
Coming up, the latest health and medical news with Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with your Mayo Clinic Minute. Weather extremes have been all too common these days, and the heat can last well into fall months. Extremes such as soaring temperatures and high humidity increase your risk of heat-related issues such as dehydration and heat stroke. But they can also increase stroke risk for some people. Dr. Robert Brown, a Mayo Clinic neurologist, says if you or someone you know experiences stroke symptoms in the heat, call 911, as stroke is a medical emergency.
Well, there is some influence of weather and temperature on the occurrence of stroke, and it ends up that it's oftentimes temperature extremes, very, very hot, very, very cold.
Or very, very humid. Dr. Brown says the increased risk of stroke may have to do with the impact extreme heat, humidity, and cold have on the body.
factors related to blood pressure and even some factors related to certain heart conditions.
Stroke is a medical emergency. The faster you get treatment, the better your chances are of recovery.
There are a number of treatments that are available at the time of stroke-related symptoms.
Symptoms include sudden onset of weakness of the face, arm, or leg, sudden numbness on one side of the body, sudden difficulty seeing, speaking, or understanding others, sudden unsteadiness, or a sudden severe headache unlike anything you've ever had before. If symptoms occur, call 911. And in other news, depression is common. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that in approximately 10% of all office visits, patients have depression listed on their charts. Some people with depression may be interested in so-called natural remedies to help. Mayo Clinic doctors say these natural remedies are not a replacement for medical diagnosis and treatment. But for some people, certain herbal and dietary supplements do seem to work well. They say more studies are needed to determine which are most likely to help and what side effects they might cause. Here are some supplements that show promise. St. John's wort. Now, this herbal supplement isn't approved by the Food and Drug Administration to treat depression in the U.S., but it's a popular depression treatment in Europe. SAM-E. This dietary supplement is a synthetic form of a chemical that occurs naturally in the body. Omega-3 fatty acids. These fats are found in cold water fish, flaxseed, flax oil, walnuts, and some other foods. Omega-3 supplements are being studied as a possible treatment for depression and for depressive symptoms in people with bipolar disorder. Saffron. Saffron extract may improve symptoms of depression, but more studies needed. And the supplement called 5-hydroxytryptophan, also known as 5-HTP, is available over-the-counter in the U.S., but requires a prescription in some countries. And DHEA, which is also a hormone that your body makes. Changes in the levels of DHEA have been linked to depression. Nutritional and dietary supplements are not monitored by the FDA the same way that medications are. You can't always be certain of what you're getting and whether it's safe, so it's best to do some research before starting any dietary supplement. Make sure you're buying your supplements from a reputable company and find out exactly what they contain. Also, because some herbal and dietary supplements can interfere with your prescription medications or cause dangerous interactions, be sure to talk to your healthcare provider before taking any supplements. For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Well, Tracy, earlier this summer, the Mayo Clinic, by the way, just named the number one hospital in the country by U.S. News and World Report. The Mayo Clinic started the process of moving to a single integrated electronic health record and a billing system. We can't forget the billing system.
Sounds like a great idea.
Well, the new system is called Epic, and that's still questionable. It's called Epic, and it is already being used at Mayo Clinic Health System sites in Wisconsin. Now, health system sites in Minnesota are scheduled to go live in November of this year, followed by Mayo Clinic's Rochester campus in May of 2018 and Mayo Clinic's campuses in Arizona and Florida in October of 2018. You know, it is a big deal with a big price tag.
The project is called the Plumber Project, as it builds on the legacy of Dr. Henry Plumber, who created the world's first patient-centered health record at Mayo Clinic more than a century ago. And here to discuss the new electronic health record is Dr. Steve Peters. Dr. Peters is a lung specialist at Mayo Clinic, and he is co-chair of the Plumber Project. Welcome to the program, Dr. Peters. It's nice to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Peters, good to have you on the program. So, a lung specialist, but I think you've now turned into an IT specialist, haven't you? I mean, I wish our listeners could see the photo behind you that shows the Epic Command Center, where you spend a fair amount of time, but you've got a huge payroll. This is a big deal.
That's correct. Thanks for having me. The Plumber Project will extend over a couple of years. It's already been in place for a couple of years as we plan this transition. Our main command center on 41st Street in Rochester has, as at its peak, about 450 people working on the project at any given moment. There are twice that many working on it overall. And that's part of the cost, of course, is the people it takes to make the transition.
We're talking about $1 billion, right?
$1 billion has been cited as an overall cost. It's somewhat misleading because only a small portion of that goes to technology. The majority of it goes to people, and that's also spread over 10 years. And you might or might not be surprised to know that with our legacy systems, we were already spending $100 million a year or more on all our electronic systems. So this will converge perhaps 250 smaller departmental or disparate systems onto the EPIC system. So in the long run, there can be savings associated with it.
We are heard on 160-plus radio stations all across the country. And right now, many of our listeners might be thinking, who cares what the Mayo Clinic is doing for their billing and records? Why does this make a difference at all to healthcare?
The reason it's important for us, and then hopefully relevant to anyone who cares about the Mayo Clinic or anyone who's been a patient or trained here or is interested in our success, is that it is a practice convergence project rather than an information technology project. Over time, as we spread to Arizona and Florida, those centers grew and they developed a different and separate electronic medical record, which occurred for good reasons at the time. In the health system, these were smaller practices and hospitals that we initially absorbed and managed more or less as a holding company. But now there's a strong desire by our leadership to create a single Mayo Clinic experience where we can spread our best practices and do things efficiently. In recent years, there's a lot more things we can do inside of the electronic medical record. For example, give decision support to nurses, pharmacists, and doctors with best practices that have been vetted and well established. But we had to build those in every system separately. When this project is done, we can put an update into production overnight, and it's everywhere from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, to Rochester, Minnesota, to Phoenix, Arizona. So there'll be a lot to be gained for the practice.
It all sounds so good, but everybody's going to have to be trained on this, right? It's not going to be easy.
Change. It's going to be change.
Yeah, the change management and the impact of the change really cannot be overstated. This is an integrated system from end to end that includes the appointment scheduling, registration, checking a patient in, recording the blood pressure and heart rate, conducting the examination, creating the documentation, all the workflow in the hospital, everything that occurs, every surgery, every blood transfusion, and then all the billing that goes along with it. So everything everyone does at Mayo Clinic, with currently of the 65,000 employees, over 50,000 people will be directly affected by this in everything they do. And it changes sometimes subtly and sometimes pretty dramatically just your typical workflows.
How long does it take to learn this? How long does it take most people? How long will it take someone like me?
Oh, boy.
It would take, the way we're planning the training is the fair amount of self-study. So what we'll ask you to do is look at some short video clips and do some preparation prior to classroom training. There will be typically 2 half-day classroom training sessions, and that gets you the basic navigation, the basic workflow, and then it takes a few weeks of seeing patients in a typical volume for you to become comfortable and with the experience that you'd gain.
Let's talk for a second about Dr. Plummer, because not only is this project called the Plummer Project, we are recording this program in the Plummer Building. Mm-hmm. Dr. Plummer is pretty important to the history
He's
of Mayo
everywhere.
Clinic.
Henry Plummer was one of the first physicians brought on by the Mayo brothers in the early 20th century, and he was sort of famous polymath and good at many things. He brought a lot of engineering design, and one of his contributions was one of the first organized paper medical records. Prior to his planning, each specialist more or less kept a cardex or a register of the patients they had seen. And he thought that it would be important to have a patient-centered record, which was a paper record in a folder that could move with the patient around the clinic so that each person in sequence could know what had happened before. He also made a great number of medical contributions, but we named this project in his honor for that history.
He certainly would be your running partner on this, wouldn't he,
well,
if he were here today?
I think he'd be impressed by how far technology has come, although he was far ahead of his time. I mentioned moving records. He also designed in the earliest versions of the Mayo Building a tube system that could allow the record to move ahead of the patient and get to the next desk or area without being manually handled.
How did you choose Epic? You know, there are a lot of options out there. How was it that you decided Epic would be the best one for Mayo?
The selection of the vendor Epic, which is a large company based just outside of Madison, Wisconsin, was a very thorough and balanced vetting with enterprise-wide participation across all Mayo sites. It took many months after the call for proposals and demonstrations by multiple of the leading medical record vendors to come to a consensus that Epic would be the best choice.
The Electronic Health Record, the Plummer Project, Mayo Clinic Lung Specialist and co-director of the Plummer Project, Dr. Steve Peters, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll preview the Mayo Clinic Center for Innovation and their upcoming conference.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
For the past 10 years, Mayo Clinic's Center for Innovation, or CFI, has been focused on finding new ways to impact, to change, to make better the future of healthcare. CFI's motto is think big, start small, and move fast.
I like it.
Pretty good. Techniques like prototyping, sketching, and brainstorming are used to try and find creative solutions to healthcare problems.
Each year, new ideas are shared at the annual CFI conference known as Transform. This year's Transform conference will take place in a few weeks, September 27th through the 29th in Rochester, Minnesota. And here to discuss Transform and the Center for Innovation is Dr. Douglas Wood. Dr. Wood is a cardiologist at Mayo Clinic and the medical director for the Center for Innovation. Welcome to the program, Dr. Wood.
Thanks very much.
Dr. Wood, nice to have you. So it sounds like you're trying to change things, hopefully for the better.
Change the world, change healthcare, change the experience of health for people for the better.
And why, what was the impetus to start the CFI, the Center for Innovation?
It grew out of a project that started in the Department of Medicine that Mayo Clinic leaders more than 10 years ago recognized that this was really the future for Mayo. And then the Center for Innovation was born.
And who works there? You, obviously, but
I'm a bit player by all means. The people who really make this go are a group of remarkable people, our designers, our project managers, our graphic artists, our IT specialists, and more important, the people we work with, the patients and the people that we follow every day to discover where there are solutions for health and healthcare.
I remember the first time that I went, I just sat there with my mouth open for most of the time. I just couldn't believe all the different fantastic conversations going on. So give us an example of some of the out-of-the-box kind of thinking that goes on.
From the Center for Innovation work, we have created the program on healthy living at Mayo. We've created the Center for Connected Care. We have started thinking about how we take care of people in communities where they live. We've opened the Well Living Laboratory, which is a remarkable partnership between Delos Living and Mayo Clinic, where we actually look at how people live and how they work. So we have a simulated apartment and a simulated office space. We've actually had Mayo Clinic employees as some of our test subjects and partners in creation.
So where do your ideas in general come from? All over?
We get ideas from all over. Much of what we get is what we discover by simply watching people and finding out where they're having trouble. But every year we also sponsor a competition of sorts or an idea generating program called CODE. It stands for Connect, Design, and Enable, and we open it to the entire Mayo Clinic. People from the entire organization can send us just a one-page summary of an idea they would like us to explore, and we get some remarkable ideas that way. Physicians come to us, nurses come to us, pharmacists come to us with ideas as well. So in our 10 years, we've worked on more than 600 projects and done more than 10,000 hours of direct patient observation.
What are some of the presentations you're looking forward to this year?
Well, this year we've got a really remarkable group of people coming. The moderator of Transform this year is Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, an award-winning journalist who wrote a series called Paying Till It Hurts for the New York Times over 2 years. And she's going to lead us through a remarkable group of people, including patients, including leaders from the business world and business schools and other physicians. So Clay Christensen will be participating. Dr. John Rico Ferrugia from Mayo Clinic, Florida, will be here on the last day to talk to us about innovation. Andy Slavitt, a former administrator of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, a Minnesotan who actually went out to Washington to help save healthcare.gov, will give us his unique perspective. So we've got lots.
Can anyone come to Transform, or do you have to be a Mayo Clinic employee?
Anyone can come to Transform. We have patients, we have doctors, we have nurses, we have inventors, we have entrepreneurs, we have insurers, we have legislators, we have lots of people. So anybody can come. We welcome everybody.
And what are the hot topics this year?
Our goal this year is to try to find a way to close the gap between people and health.
You're going to be able to do that
from
in 2 days.
From a financial standpoint?
In 2 days. Yeah. Well, the financial point would be part of it. But at first, it starts with actually understanding what we really want for people is health. With everything falling apart in Washington over the last 2 months,
sure.
I'm looking at this as a great opportunity to say, this is what we, that is people in the country, really need. And once we know what we need, we can then easily figure out a way to create those solutions and then finance them.
What about the problem? Have you tried to address the problem of obesity in this country?
We've actually taken on obesity and a number of other problems in Transform. For example, a couple of years ago, we evaluated gun violence as a public health problem. And many of these conundrums that we face in healthcare can be approached from different perspectives, and that's one of the very core principles of Transform. Get people together who think about things in a very different way. Give the attendees a chance to see that there are different ways to look at problems, and with that, often a solution that might not have been visible. We often like to say that we can make the invisible visible.
Now, you talked about some of the projects that you've been working on. What is on your plate right now that you would say is the most exciting thing and the most exciting potential innovation to come in the next few months or weeks?
At the moment, we're actually doing some interesting work with using voice to command computers and voice to help people interact with computers. So most everyone in the country knows about Alexa or Siri, and there are ways that you can have these assistants help you as a patient or as a physician have a more effective interaction with a device that could make your work better. So those are pretty exciting from my perspective. For example, if I send a patient home after surgery and they've forgotten exactly how to do a dressing, Alexa, show me how to change my dressing.
Really?
And it's there.
How did you get from being a cardiologist to being interested in innovation?
Actually, it goes back a long way, but the fun part about this job is you don't have to be really a cardiologist by training. Anybody can innovate if they can just get out of old ways of thinking. There's mm-hmm. always something that could be different or better.
What about the wearables? I mean, aren't we getting to the point where in the not too distant future, you will be able to wear something that will check your heart rate and your blood pressure and your blood sugar?
It's here. And already there are devices that are implantable. So many devices that we put in from a cardiology perspective give us lots of data. There are contact lenses that will measure your blood sugar. There are thin little strips you can put on your skin that will analyze blood tests like sodium and potassium that we would normally draw a blood specimen for and send to the laboratory. In the future, you'll just wear those. In our well-living laboratory, we're actually using sensors to evaluate how people sleep and how they move in an environment, whether we change the temperature, for example, or the wavelength of the light. We may even be able to put people to sleep without medicines in the future.
Wow, it sounds like there's going to be a big revolution, technical revolution in healthcare in the next decade or two.
Well, it needs to be technical and it needs to be personal. So whatever the technology is, it has to fit and interact with humans. Otherwise, it's not going to make a difference.
Wow. We've been talking about the Center for Innovation and its annual Transform Conference, which will be held this year, September 27th through 29th, with the Center for Innovation's medical director, Dr. Douglas Wood.
Thanks, Tom and Tracy. It was a great opportunity to chat with you.
And that's our program for this week.
Find more information on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Tweet your health and medicine questions to hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio or email us at mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.